The following is an unrehearsed interview with Avis Graves of Bardwell, Carlisle County, Kentucky. The interview was conducted by John Marshall for the Kentucky Oral History Commission in Miss Graves' home near Bardwell on August the 7th, 1978, at approximately 11 a.m. Miss Graves,
mm-hmm.
You said that your family came here when? When did you?
Around, I think it was about the mid-1830s. That is the Graves family.
The Graves family.
Uh-huh.
And the man who came here was a minister, is that right?
Well, yeah, he was Reverend Hedgeman B. Graves.
Reverend Hedgeman, how do you spell
Hedgeman? H-E-D-G-M-A-N.
Uh-huh. And where did he come from?
He came from up around Warsaw, Kentucky. That's uh-huh. right across from Cincinnati,
mm-hmm.
isn't it?
Yeah.
His wife was a Clor, C-L-O-A-R. Now, I've got that down.
No, that's all right. I want it from you.
Uh-huh.
He came here, was he sent by a church?
No, you see, body? They had opened up this Jackson Purchase. Mm-hmm. That's why all these people came in and did mm-hmm. that. It was new territory.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess he had a wandering foot, his boys seemed to have. Mm-hmm. Anyway, he arrived here. And I think it was the mid-30s. And my grandfather was born in, I was looking through that thing I had written down, 1848, I believe.
Your grandfather was born in?
My grandfather, Dr. Graves, Dr. William Thomas Graves.
They
called him Bill.
He was the son of Hedgeman B.
He was the youngest son, mm-hmm. youngest child.
Where did Reverend Graves establish himself as a preacher?
Well, I'm very sketchy about that. I know at one time he was preaching at St. Genevieve, Missouri. His wife's buried there, my great-grandmother, at St. Genevieve, Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
And the history published last year of Carlisle County said he was, for 33 years, he was pastor out at Mississippi Baptist Church, mm-hmm. right west of Bardwell. Yeah. 33 years.
Where was he living when your grandfather was born?
They lived where Bardwell now is, but Bardwell wasn't there. Right about there.
Mm-hmm. And he was
a very interesting thing about him being pastor there. And my grandfather, later, after he was married, built a home within a half a mile of the church, and he belonged to the church, of course, where his father had been pastor.
Mm-hmm.
And he went to a medical convention one week, and while he was gone, my grandmother, who wasn't a member of the church, she belonged, had a different faith, let the girls have a dance, and they turned Popo out of the church. But he got...
Yeah.
So he never belonged anymore. He would go to church and he'd support the church, and they'd try to get him to join later on when they were more lenient about
yeah.
sinners dancing,
yeah.
and but he never would join again.
Yeah.
And one of the man who was the principal instigator turning him out was my mother's cousin, and had married her, my mother's paternal cousin, who had married her maternal aunt, Uncle Henry Terry.
Uh-huh.
So Papa never did like Uncle Henry.
Yeah. when did the churches, just while you mentioned that, when did the churches change their policy?
I don't know, and I'm not right sure that they've even changed.
Changed it, yeah. I know that some churches are still...
I don't know. It might still be that they wouldn't approve of dancing.
Uh-huh.
I don't know.
But I don't think now that they would turn out the county position.
But I don't believe they turn out the husband of the wife who gave...
Yeah, right.
If he was away, especially.
Yeah. But what was your grandmother's name?
My grandmother was a Hogan Camp.
Uh-huh.
Her name was Mary Elizabeth Hogan Camp.
She was the one who allowed the girls to have the...
She let the girls yeah. have the dance. There she had, there were four. She had four girls, and she let them have a dance.
Do you have any idea when that was?
No, I don't.
Mm-hmm.
they were about grown, but I don't have any idea when it was. Of course, mm-hmm. they were grown, so the older ones were teenagers, I guess.
Now, you were telling me earlier that Reverend Graves, your great-grandfather, right, Hedgeman Graves,
mm-hmm.
Had some sons
yes.
who were pretty interesting. Tell me about the...
Well, let me see. I believe it was Chatham, C-H-A-T-H-A-M. Could I look at something to refresh my memory?
Just tell me.
I think it is Chatham.
Yeah.
He's a you know, young fella, and his father sent him out to the pasture one morning to get him a horse to drive that day. And Chatham didn't come back. So they went to look for him and found the bridle hanging on a fence post. He didn't leave any note or anything. But a long time afterwards, they heard from him, and he was in the gold fields out in California.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether this was after his... No, this couldn't have been after his mother died. It is, of course, it was just about the time my grandfather was born. I think mm-hmm. he was just about a year old at the time. It was about 1849 he went out to the gold fields. And they heard later from him, and he said that he'd made his strike and had money, and he was coming home. He had gone out by boat, and that he was coming through back by land.
Mm-hmm.
And he never did reach home.
They never heard from him again?
And it is years. My grandfather was married, grown and married, and they in a remote section of the mountains in Arkansas, those arts. The sheriff of the county wrote and said that they had found some old saddlebags and had some old papers in them, and the papers were his papers. That is all. And a skeleton. The skeleton was there.
Hmm.
So my grandfather, who was just a year old when he left, went out and had the remains buried and brought the saddlebags home.
Hmm. That really is an interesting story.
That
is
interesting.
It makes you wonder how he found out about the gold strike.
Well, people, everybody knew about it.
Well,
I guess, you know, they went from all over the United States.
But that's when he went. He went right out there in 1848,
Well,
49.
It is 49, I think. Mm-hmm. My grandfather was born in 48. I think it is 49 or maybe 50, mm-hmm. somewhere along there.
Yeah.
It had had time to get, the news was around, mm-hmm. of course. He knew about the gold fields because I don't know how he went. Probably went down to New Orleans and caught a boat or something.
Yeah, why he chose that time, that's what's really
And see, he had to go all around South America to get out there then, because there wasn't any canal.
Yeah, or if he went by boat.
You'd have to.
Yeah. Hmm.
Well, that's what he had really made a strike. He'd
mm-hmm.
struck it rich, and that he was coming home, that he had gone out by boat, and he was coming back by land. My great aunt Ellen, his sister, in her latter years, lived with her nieces and nephews. All her family was dead, and she lived with her nieces and nephews, and she stayed around with us, and she was the one who told me about that.
Mm-hmm. That really is interesting.
Uh-huh.
And another one of the sons served in the Civil War, is that right?
Yeah, well, let me see. Uncle, what is his name? I can't think. Let me see. There was one named Nimrod.
Where does that name come from? I've heard that before. But it's
Nimrod,
unusual
he was a Greek hunter, wasn't he, I think.
Is that right?
The mighty men Nimrod. I'm not right sure, but
I don't know.
Chatham and Nimrod, and this one was more or less considered the black sheep of the family. He went off and lived with the Indians, and he joined the Union Army. And one time years ago when I was in Vicksburg looking at all the monuments, and there was, I believe it was an Illinois regiment, they had the names
mm-hmm.
of all of them, and there was his name. His name was, well, it's Lewis, wasn't it? Pretty sure it was.
Uh-huh.
Lewis Grace.
Yeah, is that L-O-U-I-S?
I think it was. I think that was his name.
Uh-huh. And
Where did he live with the Indians? That's interesting.
Well, I don't know. They were all around. You see, we had just shoved the Indians out of here in 1819. I mean, bought this and gotten rid of them. Mm-hmm. He didn't have far to go. I don't know just where he was with. It was west, though, west of Mississippi, I think.
Were there ever any family stories about his times with the Indians? Any of his...
No, we never did know anything about him.
After
then,
that, huh?
He got, and they never talked very much about him. They were really Southern sympathizers, and he was in the Union Army. Yeah. I guess is the reason, I don't know.
Yeah.
Now, he had a, Grandpa Hedgeman had another boy that was a preacher. He was Elder James Graves, Uncle Jim.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a Universalist preacher.
Well,
you ever heard of Universalist?
I've heard of it, but
well,
I don't
now,
know.
It no longer exists. It's been absorbed by some other church. I've forgotten what it was, the Unitarians or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But this was Universalist. And the reason I know, when I was in the store at Bardwell, one day this young man came in and he asked me if I were Graves. And he was looking up the records on the Universalist Church. He had graduated from Harvard, and his thesis was on the Universalist Church, and at Providence, Rhode Island, he had found records about Uncle Jim.
Hmm.
And Uncle Jim had established a church here in the Universalist faith, and they would meet around in homes. I don't believe they ever had a church.
In a building.
A building.
Uh-huh.
They just met in homes.
Mm-hmm.
But that boy was writing a thesis on the Universalist Church.
Hmm.
And so,
so
I called one of my uncles, and I said, Uncle Dan, was Uncle Jim Graves a Universalist preacher? He said, oh, I don't know. He was some kind of a jackleg preacher. Uncle Dan was a Baptist.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that was him. Well, now, let me see. He had another son who was a preacher, but he was a Baptist, and he taught school some here in the state, in the county, and had a farm here. And his descendants, Ralph Ed Graves, Ralph W. Graves, that had the Carlisle County News, was his grandson, Ralph W. And then Ralph's son, Ralph Ed, had the Carlisle County News and about a couple of other papers, and he was also our representative. That was Uncle Joe's side of the family. And let me see, who else did he have? Uncle Frank. Frank and Ellen were twins, and then Ellen is the one that gave me most of this information. And Frank joined the Confederate Army and was a captain under Bragg, and here in Kentucky, right at the beginning of the war, he got captured and spent all of the war in a federal prison. And when he got out, he had TB.
Mm-hmm.
And in his latter years, he died at my grandfather's house. Of course, Papa had grown up in the meantime and married. Oh yes, about my great-grandfather Hedgeman, I thought this was right interesting. They were very Southern in their sympathies, and evidently he was preaching that way. And so the federal forces, after they had occupied Columbus, came out and picked him up and took him to put him in their their prison. Well, my grandfather, Papa, was, I guess, a teenage boy at the time, living with him, and that left him at loose ends, so they just took him too. They took both of them. Now, I ain't ever said they did. They took him down there and put him in prison for a time. Because he was preaching.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Where did they put him in prison, do you know?
Well, in Columbus, just in a, you know, they just held him. I don't think they held him too long, but they were trying to stop him from preaching sermons against him.
Yeah.
And I imagine he is doing quite a bit of it.
Now, the one who was captured by the Union forces and put in the Union prison almost for all the Civil War, when he was captured in Kentucky, where was he captured, you know?
I don't know, and I asked Aunt Ellen that. She said it was at some bridge. They went out one morning on a to reconnoitre, and that at some bridge they were ambushed, and he was captured. And it is right at, that is while Bragg, while the forces, the Confederate forces were still in Kentucky. It is right at the beginning of the war. And so he spent his the war in a federal prison.
That's a hard way to do it, isn't it? Well, now your grandfather, Dr. William Thomas Graves, you said, had to go to prison with his father.
Well, he did, yeah, they took him. That's what Aunt Evans said. So they took, they didn't have anything against him, but he was there. Well, he would have been left by himself. I don't know how, he was about a teenager. 1848 from 65 is what, 17? Don't know why, but they took him, she said. Well, it wouldn't be 65, it'd be 61. He was about 14. So they just took, well, he's about the age of, I've got a couple of little nephews here. They're getting teenagers, 13. So they just took him along, too.
Now, you've collected some local reminiscences and recollections about the Battle of Belmont.
Yes, I have.
Can you just, off the top of your head, tell me a few of the way that that battle affected some people locally?
Well, let me see. It was on November the 7th in 1861, wasn't it? And evidently that fall had been a late fall. It was pretty, and you know, and on November the 7th, my great-grandfather, Everett Hogenkamp, H-O-G-A-N-C-A-M-P, Everett Hogenkamp. And three of his boys were out in the field harvesting some late potatoes, they said. Now, why in the world potatoes would be that late, I don't know. Well, I guess they could. And his oldest boy, Marion, was about nine. And I don't remember who the middle one was, and then Uncle John must have been about five. Anyway, they were digging, they were out in the field digging potatoes when the cannon, you know, the the batteries at Pope's forces at Columbus had sighted the gunboats coming down the river. They parked out of range of the shells of, on the Missouri side, but they were shooting at them. So the guns began to roar. And he said, I said, well, boys, we're not going to work anymore today. He said, men are being killed nearby. And he said, we'll not work anymore. And said he went to the house and got his Bible and went into a room by himself. Now, that was just one little incident.
Yeah, that's...
Barbara Mantle Allen, and let's see, Mrs. Burke Allen, Barbara Allen Mantle, said that her grandfather... Now, I can't think of his name. It's Coley. They called him C-O-L-I-E, Coley. His name was a boy about 13, or he was about 14. And he, they could hear it all out this far, you know. They could hear the battle, of course. And it'd even shake the windows out this far. We were close to Old Mayfield Church, and it'd shake the windows and shake the ditches on the shelves, you know. Well, he heard it, and he got on a mule and rode down there. And when he got down there, boy, well, they put him carrying things. That was on, that was Pope's forces. Well, they, that was in the afternoon, I guess, because it had taken him some time to get down there on the mule. Well, of course, in the morning, the federal forces overran Belmont. And then Pope began sending reinforcements over and almost trapped them. They had fought all the way back to the gunboats. Well, Coley was there as a messenger boy for the Union, for the Southern forces. And he went, they said, he went across the river with them and got captured by the Union forces. And they put him to work as a messenger boy. And much to the disgust of his family, who were all Southern sympathizers, but they evidently took him on back with them because later on he got a Union pension in his older days, wasn't that funny?
Something.
I wrote a mule down there. Well, let me see. Iva Wilson's mother Her name was Oliphant, O-L-I-P-H-A-N-T, and I don't know what her first name was. Lived out by Mayfield Creek, which is very near here. This is about 4 or 5 miles on the east side of Bardwell. She remembered the guns beginning, her mother did, Miss Oliphant. She was a single lady at the time. And, remembered the guns and the dishes and said her mother fainted. You know, there was this roar. It was just really very frightening, you know. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the windows were broken out in the vicinity mm-hmm. by the concussion. And that late that afternoon, this Uncle Henry Terry, who voted to put Popo out of the church, mm-hmm. I was a boy about 9 or 10 years old, and they sent him to the pasture to bring in the cows. Now, he didn't remember the, isn't it funny? Mm-hmm. He didn't remember the bombardment, but he remembered the rifle. That was on the west side of Bardwell and wasn't so many miles from the river, you see, mm-hmm. about 6, 7, 8 miles from the river, and they were fighting their way back up on the Missouri shore, and he could hear the musket. All that, and he sat on a rail fence and listened to the battle while he went to bring in the cows. And he always said, well, they said the Battle of Columbus is fought, the Battle of Belmont is fought in the morning, but they were wrong because he heard it in the afternoon. And he didn't remember the, mm-hmm. the cannon. Isn't that funny?
Yeah.
Very peculiar.
He must have blocked it out.
Yeah. And let me see what some other people told me about that.
Well, that's interesting. Did you hear any stories of when the cannon exploded?
Oh, I know about that, and that's an interesting thing.
Yeah.
You know, when I was a child, I guess for school age, 4 or 5, well, on later, I guess, the old Clump Road to Columbus from Bardwell, when it got to Berkeley, ran out to the river and went along the edge of the river.
Yeah.
And Papa, I'd be riding along there with Papa, and we'd come to this big old oak tree, and he'd say, there was a big sort of a sunken place there under the tree between the road and the river. And he'd say, Avis, that's where some Confederate soldiers are buried. They were blown up by this cannon. He'd say, now this is what they told in the neighborhood, I don't know. He said, during the battle, the gun got hot and it had a shell in it. And they didn't shoot it out, and it cooled, and when the gun cooled, it contracted and held that shell in there. And said that those men didn't want to shoot it, but said the officers made them, and said they killed them all. I've forgotten how many, some, several. And said that they didn't want to do it. Well, he was entirely wrong about that, but that was what they told here.
Uh-huh.
What really happened, because I have a book by a boy who was there,
uh-huh.
and then I've read Pope's account of it. Pope was there himself.
Uh-huh.
This gun, it had cooled off, you know, and they were wondering how they were going to get it, and they were going to shoot it. So Pope went down to see it done, and he was standing there, and this boy that wrote the account said that he went up with the boy to pull the lanyards, you know, why they put the charge mm-hmm. in, I guess recharge it,
mm-hmm.
and said that when the boy ran back with the lanyard, he ran with the boy, and said that was all that saved him, because evidently that lanyard went way back, and he got back far enough that it didn't kill him. All anywhere close to the gun were killed. And Pope, standing there watching, it not too far off, split his coat down the back just like you had taken a sword and split it right down the back, and he bled at the ears for several days. He wrote his wife and told her about it really injured him. He was it almost killed him.
Yeah. Well, I've heard that pieces of that cannon went great distances. Have you heard any stories about that?
Well, I don't know about that.
Uh-huh.
But they gathered these men up from down in the bottom below the bluff, you know, and they said scattered around in the trees and everywhere. It just blew the cannon and them.
Distances.
all to pieces.
Yeah.
But the people here were Southern sympathizers, mm-hmm. and of course they sympathized with a common soldier, too.
Right.
And so they said the officers made them do it. Mm-hmm. But that was, well, they did have them do it, but they didn't know it was going to explode.
Mm-hmm.
Because it almost got their commanding general.
Yeah, right. Obviously, they didn't know it was going to explode. Oh, okay. Well, that's interesting. What, your grandfather now, I think you just mentioned that you used to go on rounds with him. He was a doctor.
Well, I did a little bit. It's my father that I used to travel around with a lot, but I've been with my father, my grandfather on.
Have you?
And let me tell you an interesting thing about one of his visits. This was before my day, of course. He was making a trip on horseback down, he lived out west of Bardwell, his country practice, and on down in all the river bottom there, and on the hills around the river bottom. And the last family he called on had, some of the men had been squirrel hunting, and had brought in just a bunch of squirrels they'd killed, and of course they said, probably part of their fee. I don't know. That is the way he is paid in produce mostly, you know, back then. But anyway, probably they just gave them to him. Anyway, he had several squirrels they'd given him, and he tied them onto his saddle and started back home and said that he was coming along through this dense woods, and he heard a woman scream. There was a woman, a family lived there that had a girl that was crazy, and she would get out times, you know, and just scream, just yell. Mm-hmm. And he thought, well, there's that poor girl out. This time it's getting late, almost dark. And out awfully late. And didn't think anything more about it and plodded on his horse and said, all at once, well, the scream came again, although he had gone some distance and it was nearer. And he, of course, began using his brain. Then it sort of waked him up. He was being pursued by a panther through the trees, and it smelled the squirrels.
Good heavens.
But he had a good saddle horse, and he took off. Yeah. Yeah, got away. But there were quite a few in this area at that time.
Mm-hmm. What variety of panther is there? What
it's puma. Puma.
Uh-huh. Well, they only live in the West now, don't they?
Oh, no. When I was, I guess about... lay 10 or 11 years old, there was one in the area west of Bardwell. High water one winter drove it out.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. And I had an aunt that had an experience with that. She never would say it was a panther, but I guess it was.
Can you tell me that?
Yeah, it was very interesting.
Yeah.
And my mother's half-sister, Aunt Tilda Lowe, T-I-L-D-A, Tilda L-O-W-E, and she lived with her son, Vester Lowe, and his wife. About 5 miles west of Bardwell. And a lot of people had, the panther had been seen. They'd found his tracks. It had killed some he could kill some of the livestock. And, but people were, well, they're just a little bit uneasy, but not too much so. So Aunt Tilda one day decided the hens need new nests, and she took a sheet and went down to the straw stack in the field to get some fresh straw. And it was, they used to have these big haystacks, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the stock through the winter had wintered there, and they make it almost like a mushroom, you know, they eat around.
Yeah.
Well, they had, there was one place, there was a hole all the way through, you could see through it. Well, she got in under there where she could get some nice fresh straw and began to pull it down. And the hole was stopped up with straw that had just been sort of shoved up there. And she heard something on the other side of the that straw. So she thought, well, some of Vester's calves are in here. I'll see and tell him. And said she pushed the straw back and looked through, and she said it, she wouldn't ever say it was panther. She said it was something bigger than a dog, and said it was pacing this way, you know, and had sniffing, had its nose up this way. And she was an old lady, I guess about 60, in her 60s or 70s. And there was barbed wire across the fence. She didn't stop to open the gate going back, and she doesn't remember how she got over the fence. But she got over the fence and got back home. And she never would say it was a panther. But and they thought it was the Panther. Yeah, yeah. That it had been asleep there and she had disturbed it.
Uh-huh. Did they send the men down there to find it?
Well, I think by the time she got back, there wasn't anybody, you know, there to send at the time. And no, yeah. I don't know whether they went, probably somebody, some of them went down to investigate later, I don't know.
Yeah.
But that, now I had a cousin, Papa had a cousin, who claimed that that was all, that it wasn't so, that there wasn't a Panther. He said that he made some of the tracks, and I think he did fix a foot, you know, and he'd make tracks and get people excited about it. But I can remember when a bunch of men coming by the house one morning, and they had walked about a couple of miles, and the light snow was on the ground,
mm-hmm.
and they were tracking this animal. Hidden, and it had come down across the fields, and they came by our house, and they followed it on, and it went almost, they tracked it on almost to Arlington, over to Cherry's schoolhouse. Mr. Will Cherry said the night before that he was disturbed by something bothering his turkeys, which roosted in a big cedar tree outside of the house, and that he...
Okay.
Well, and his dog, they wouldn't, he couldn't get them to go at all.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that he didn't know, but they tracked it there. Mm-hmm. That whatever this animal was, it was a big animal, and they had tracked it to these turkeys.
Mm-hmm.
So there was something. If it wasn't a panther, it was some kind of a big animal all winter. It was one winter. The water, high water, had run it out into the section west of Bardwell.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. We were in there then.
How long has it been since anybody's heard of a panther in this area?
That was the last one.
Yeah.
I never have heard of any other. Now, my daddy said, my father said that when he was young, that they weren't uncommon.
Mm-hmm.
And one night, he and a bunch of his uncles, the Hogenkamps, they had a big pack of hunting dogs, and they were out... I don't know what hunting. And he said that they heard a panther. It was over on, they were on one ridge and it was on the other, but said it would stop and scream every now and then, you know.
Mm.
And then said they could hear it walking. It came on down and they could hear it walking in the leaves, could hear the leaves, you know. And said their dogs all came in and got under their legs. That's what they do.
Mm.
You know, they're afraid of them.
Yeah, well, it's understandable.
It's, uh-huh. So that was one reason. I'm pretty sure that was a panther at Mr. Cherry's. Mm. The dogs were scared. And Papa said that the dogs really were frightened of panthers, that they would not go. You couldn't get them to go.
Mm. Now, your grandfather, where this is Dr. Graves.
Dr. Graves.
Where was he, where did he... study medicine?
He studied with a Dr. Thomas, you know, and I don't know. He went somewhere, but I really don't know.
Uh-huh.
But you know, it wasn't the same. He had to pass an examination. But he worked, he studied and worked with a Dr. Thomas here for a long time, I know.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And then I think he studied medicine while his family was young, and as he started raising his family, as I understand it, I'm not sure about that.
When did he sort of formally set up a practice around in this area? Do you know?
I wouldn't know when. He was, he had evidently been a doctor for some years. He died when I was 12.
Uh-huh.
And he had been, must have been practicing a long time because everybody, of course, and I used to occasionally take his horse and buggy. He drove a horse named Old Bill.
Mm-hmm.
And she was taking up orders, you know. We were little girls. And I remember us having Old Bill one time and taking him, going around, and she'd stop and go in the house and get people to take orders from her. And then she'd get some kind of a prize. I don't know what it was. And we'd stop and hitch Old Bill and go in the house, you know. And in a little while, somebody would come in and want to see the doc.
Hmm.
Everybody knew Old Bill, you know. And if they, any time that you were in the neighborhood, see, that was in the days before telephones.
Mm-hmm.
And if they saw the horse, well, they would know that it was the doctor's rig. I guess he was riding horseback, and then he had a little team of mules called Red and Nig that he used. We never did drive them. But if we drove old Bill, well, we'd be followed a lot of times, but people wanted to see the doctor.
Mm-hmm. Well, you went with him sometimes on rounds.
Well, not often. Pick me up now and then and take me. If he happened to come down by our house and was going in that area and coming back that way, you see.
Uh-huh. Did he ever tell you any much about his medical practice? Do you?
No. I had a cousin who's a few years, about 4 years older than me, that they raised. Her mother died, and she grew up there, and I've heard her talk about, you know, how people would come to the house. They had people to eat with them all the time. They'd come, you see, early in the morning. They'd come before daylight, get there about daylight, wanting the doctor to come. See, they had to come and get mm-hmm. him.
Yeah, sure.
And so they'd say, well, come on in and eat breakfast. And they'd eat breakfast, and then he'd go, you see. They'd come all through the night. Mm-hmm. And people would stop and holler out front. They had a stile, what they called a stile block, a place to hitch horses and some mm-hmm. steps to go down. And they said that they'd, you know, stop out there and holler. And, Doc, can you come? You know, this, that. He had a wide practice, all even people from Columbus. He had, some of them were his mm-hmm. patients. Mm-hmm. And one night they said that this, hello, out in front of the house. And Papa had a sort of a high temper. And said that he went to the, of course, middle of the night. He is used to it, though. Yeah. Went to the door and, yes. Ken, they said it was just as black as pitch black, so dark you couldn't see your hand before your face. And said, they said, this voice says, am I headed for Bardwell? And said, Papa says, how the hell do I know? And slammed the door. And said, then after he thought it over and he opened the door and he said, where did you start from, and have you turned around since you left? But they were used to that. Yeah. And Cecil said one night Oscar Wilson came running up there and said, oh, doctor says they've had a wreck down here now in the days of Boogie. They've had a wreck down here and there's a man killed, a Boogie turned over and a man killed, and they're bringing him up here. And Cecil said she started crying and saying, I don't want to see a dead man. I don't want to see a dead man. So they brought him up. He was drunk. So Papa, of course, could tell he wasn't hurt. But in the meantime, they'd started after the boy's mother. And they got her and brought her. Well, both of them spent the night at Papa's. Now, they had that all the time, you see, just things like that happening.
It's amazing, isn't it?
And I remember one time he was talking about two women had a fight down in the hills around the river, and one of them cut the other's nose off with a butcher knife, just mm-hmm. sliced it. He sewed that back on. You see, he did everything. He set bones and sewed noses so back on.
Now he was born in 1848, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Right. So he was.
I think that's. I'm pretty sure I'm right about that.
Right around the turn of the century, in the 1880s and 90s, he would have been the height of his practice, I guess.
Yes, I guess he was. 1890s? Yeah, I was born in 1899. He'd been practicing, you see, some time.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Yeah. Did he live long enough to have an automobile? Did he?
No. Now, they were beginning, let me see, 1912. Hmm. They were beginning to have automobiles. Mm-hmm. He had retired. His health was bad. I was 12. I don't know. Let's see. I run with the years. That's the reason mm-hmm. I know when. Yeah. If I say I was 12, why is it? He died when I was 12. Well, he hadn't practiced for a year or two. Mm-hmm. But the reason I know about that time, Papa taught at Chestnut Ridge, which was right up above my grandfather's house, mm-hmm. out close to Mississippi Church.
Yeah.
And I must have been about 8 or 9. Well, that is about 8 or 9. They had cars, I guess. And I didn't remember this. Somebody at Milburn was telling me not long ago, said that one day we heard an automobile while we were in school there at Chestnut Ridge, heard an automobile coming. You know, you could hear them for, a long time before they got there. So Papa dismissed school and let all the children go out to the road to see the automobile go by. Mm-hmm. And it was Dr. Mosby, one of Papa's co-workers and a good friend of his. But he never had a car. No. But Dr. Mosby did about that time.
Where was Chestnut Ridge School?
Is it on the Bardwell at the Berkeley Road? And that's about all I can tell you. It was about a mile up north of the Mississippi Baptist Church that's on that same road to Berkeley. And it must be, well, it must be about 4 or 5 miles out from Bardwell. That's a high. Going towards Berkeley, it sat on the right-hand side of the road, and Sandy Branch Hollow was behind it. And Sandy Branch Hollow was formed from sand from a spring, mostly. That right there, there was a Wilson family settled there close to that spring, and he, Ivan Wilson, and my great-grandfather Hogenkamp, Everett Hogenkamp, started off as partners, and when they settled here, it was not long after this territory was opened, and there was a spring near the Wilson house. I was divided up one time, and the Wilsons took this. And I've heard them say that in that spring, one time they found a fish that had come out in the spring and it didn't have any eyes, which indicates the cave, of course.
Yeah.
Well, over about a half a mile, I guess Mr. Randall was living there now, Wilson owns it now, dug him a well and he hit nothing. And they said that you could put a threshing machine whistle over that thing and it'd blow the whistle. The air came in and went out. It was sort of a breathing effect, you know.
Nice.
Now, Lloyd Wilson could tell you about that. I don't know whether it's still there or not.
That's interesting.
But that was when I was, you know, around 11, 12. It's been a long time ago that was done. But there must be, but that Sandy Branch Hollow has just changed amazingly through the years. I haven't been down it in years and years and years, but you could tell the change, you know, how it filled in.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder what's underneath us.
How old were you when the woman was thrown in the cistern?
Why?
How old were you when the woman was thrown in the cistern?
Oh, see, I wasn't thin at all. That was right after the Civil War, 1870.
70s. Would you tell that story for me?
Can't you get it from... I think the family would tell you.
I probably can.
Because he'd do it better, you know. He knows it more. Well, I'll be glad to tell it. I knew her when I was about 15. She must have been about 70, you know. Mm-hmm. And she was lived there in Arlington, and we were always sort of in awe of her because they... just said that she'd been thrown down a cistern.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I had some friends that lived across the street from her, and I saw them not long ago at a party, and they were telling me that she used to have them over when they were little girls, have them over for high tea, and they just adored it, you know, and they had adored her, but I was sort of leery of them. Anyway, the story about the cistern is that it is about 1870, I think they said, it is right after the Civil War was over. And, of course, money was hard to get.
Mm.
And her husband, Kit Powell, had accumulated a few hundred dollars and had it in cash there at the house, you know. And at that time, they had a cook who had a son, a grown man. And the cook would cook dinner and leave and then come back in early to fix supper. And one day, after she had left at noon, the colored man threw Aunt Matt into the cistern. It was on a back porch attached to the house. And he took the money and set off, left. She, fortunately, a tree that grew right near the porch had a root. Had broken the wall of the cistern, it had run into the cistern. There was a root there that she could hold on to and keep her above water. But she'd get tired. And she had long hair, and she tied her hair around that, said, so that if she did get so tired she couldn't hold on, while the hair would hold her head above water. Mm-hmm. And she just waited, knew the woman, the colored woman, would be back to fix supper. And she did. When she came back, why, Aunt Matt could tell, she could feel the vibration in the house. They were walking through the house, that the porch was connected. And she began to scream, and the woman came, and... got people to help, and they got her out of the cistern. Mm. Now, Walter Lee Davis says he knows the cistern. Mm-hmm. Been on that porch in the cistern often.
Now, what was the lady's name who was thrown in the cistern?
Matt Powell. Mm-hmm. And we called her Aunt. Everybody called her Aunt because she was old. Matt Powell, M-A-T-T, and her husband was Kit Powell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, Mr. Kit got on his horse and took out after the man that had thrown her into the cistern, and caught him over around Blandville.
Mm-hmm.
and he was lynched. They hung him over there.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, he knew who he was. I don't know whether he got his money back or not.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know about that. But that, and then when Aunt Matt died, she died in sometime in the 1920s, mm-hmm. around 1930. And they opened her will, and she wanted to be buried at midnight. So they buried her at midnight. And I don't know why. Somebody said she didn't want to have anybody come to her funeral, and that she had twice as many at midnight than if she would have had if she'd been buried in the daytime.
I guess that's right. Yeah. Well, you thought of her, well, like you said, when you were just a little girl, you thought of her sort of as a witch because she'd been
thrown in the cistern. Well, she had that tale about her, you know, mm-hmm. and you know, and she dressed in black always.
Yeah.
But she was a sort of a big, imposing looking woman, yeah. you know. And she said that she always wore sensible shoes, and her feet were as pretty and dimpled as a baby's.
Yeah.
She was a little peculiar.
Yeah.
You can tell by the will,
right.
you know.
Yeah.
I don't know whether that experience made her that way, or whether she was just naturally that way.
Hmm.
But the Powell, not very many Powell relatives, still live at Arlington, and they could give you that story. It really is an interesting story.
Yeah. Now, your father was a school teacher.
Yes, he always owned a farm, but he wasn't very much of a farmer. But he loved to teach.
Mm-hmm. Now, what was his name?
Frank Graves.
Uh-huh. All right, and tell
he,
me.
You know, it was a funny thing. I left here in 1920 and lived in Mississippi until 1949. And when I came back up here, one of my uncles had a store that he wanted to get rid of and asked me if I would consider taking it over, and I did. And I started off with a little old store, practically nothing. But it was amazing how many friends of my father's would come in to trade with, people I didn't know. And they'd come in and they'd say, I'm Jane Doe or I'm John Doe, and I went to school to Mr. Frank.
Mm-hmm.
And our I knew your father, and he really, after all those years, started me off in business pretty well.
Well,
and he made it a rule, never, the reason he was taught, you know, so many people knew him some all over the county was, in those days, you see, it was about each little district sat by itself, and that community stayed by itself,
yeah.
you know, they didn't mingle much. Berkeley and Bardwell were far apart,
mm-hmm.
and if you lived at Berkeley, you didn't associate with the people at Bardwell much, hardly ever saw them. It was sort of like going to Paducah,
mm-hmm.
or something like that. And he would teach at these little country schools, and he made it a rule never to teach but 2 years at any one place. He said, I think it is because he liked to meet new people. He said it is because that he thought he might have a little animosity building up against him, but somebody, he'd always make somebody mad. But a lot of times he'd go back, so I don't think it was that. He really liked to meet people,
mm-hmm.
and he'd teach 2 years, then he'd get him another one and teach 2 years. So I went to school all over the county before the days of consolidation. I knew people all over the county, but just by him teaching.
But you went with him?
I went with him.
Wherever he taught, you went to
yes,
school?
Yes, and if it was near enough in the summertime, we'd still stay at home, and he and I'd drive in the buggy, horse and buggy, to school and back until the weather got bad. And then when the weather got bad, why, he'd rent a house, and we'd move enough to do light housekeeping. But we'd still come back to the farm on weekends, you know, down by Bartle. Now, one time he taught at Berkeley. This is before I was old enough to go to school, but I can remember it. I must have been about 4 or 5. And we moved there for the winter into a very small house. And one day Berkeley is right near Fish Lake and the string of lakes that run through the bottom. And he was, I don't know what he is out in the bottom about, but he went horseback ride. He was on a horse. And he, coming back, there was a field of corn that had been harvested into shocks. And there was a flock of wild geese feeding in the field. There were also some cattle there. So he was on a horse we were very fond of, a member of the family called Belle, and she was so very light-stepping. And he got right into the flock before they knew he was there on account of the cattle. They, you know, they'd been used to the cattle. And even then there was one gander, I think he was, that had his head into the shock and didn't hear him. So Papa got off of Belle and grabbed him by the legs. And he said that in a little while he wished he hadn't, because he nearly beat him to death. Yeah. You know, he was bruised for days. Those things are strong.
Yeah.
But he held on and got him tied some way. I guess he had a rope on the saddle. And thanks to Belle being so gentle, he brought him home. He got up on the and brought him home. Well, that night, there wasn't a place to put him, and he didn't want to kill him. And so he tied, Mama had a sewing machine out on a back porch, a little back porch, enclosed back porch. It was a very small house we were living in. And all through the night, that gander would pull that sewing machine, trundled it up and down that porch. He was that strong. You know, he could move it. You could hear that old machine going, you know, just trundling along that back porch. Well, the next morning, Mama told him, said, get rid of the goose. So there was a neighbor that said that she'd like to have him. She thought she would put him with her flock of geese, tame him. And so he gave him to her, and she cut off one wing, and so he couldn't fly, and put him in with her flock of geese. But that didn't, you know, that wing didn't bother him. He took off, and he couldn't fly, but he could hover right above the ground, you know. And Papa said the last he ever saw that goose, he was headed back to the bottom with this woman behind him trying to catch him. Instead, he would just hover right above the ground and go fast, that he could really go travel fast, you know.
where was your father? What sort of training did your father have to be a teacher?
He didn't have any. You had to take a teacher's examination in those days.
Do you know where he took it?
Oh, they had them here in the county at the county seats all the time. He used to coach, help young people that wanted to pass the examination. I can remember him staying at our house often, and him helping them right before an examination, you know.
Was that exam was given by the state?
It was the state. I'm sure it is the state.
Yeah.
And they used to have, and I don't remember what they call these, but I've been with him to them. They were some kind of teacher's institute or something they'd have here through the summertime. And I remember one time being with him at Bardwell, and I don't know whether I guess I was school age. And Professor John T. Cotton Noe from the University of Kentucky was there. And he was a poet. He had a little book published, poems published. And they had, somebody was selling prints of birds. And Papa got me a bluebird and a redbird. And Professor Noe took the redbird and wrote on the back, "The mountain redbirds flashed and flew around the rude cabin of John and Sue." And that was from one of his poems. That's the only way, the reason I remember him. But I had that for a long, long time and then signed his name to it. And he was at the University of Kentucky for years. Mm-hmm. I know because I've heard people talk about him. But they'd have these, and I guess they would bring in people like that to lecture, you know, and mm-hmm. so on and so forth. But they were county, they were in the counties. I'm sure they're state-sponsored, but they were in the counties. Uh-huh. But they'd have them in the summertime. I guess they had one every summer. I don't remember for sure.
Do you have any ideas how many, any idea how many schools there were in Carlisle County when your father was teaching?
Oh, no, I don't. There was an awful lot of them. Let me see, he taught at Berkeley.
Tell me where he taught it.
Well, I don't know that. Remember, Berkeley, that is before I was old enough to go to school.
Yeah.
And he taught at Gupton, and he taught at Black, and he taught at Wright, W-R-I-G-H-T. See, they were all named from men, I guess they'd get the land from the men, mm-hmm. you know. And Chestnut Ridge, that was a different name. It was, mm-hmm. And Cherry, that is named from old Mr. Bill Cherry. And then from Cherry, we went to Arlington. Now that's all let me see. Then before I was born, he had taught at Dicus.
Dicus?
D-I-C-U-S, Dicus. Hmm. Or D-Y-C-U-S, I don't know which it is. I remember him talking about
that. It's just called Dicus School, huh?
They were all just schools. Cherry School, Dicus School.
Black School.
Black School.
Was Gupton just called Gupton School?
Gupton School. Yeah. Uh-huh, see. But they were all named for men mm-hmm. that had the Mr. The Gupton, Mr. Black, and Mr. all of them, Wright, and all mm-hmm. of them were named for men. And at one year, I didn't... I went to Bardwell we stayed at home until bad weather, and Papa and I drove to Black School. Then when bad weather set in, we moved to Bardwell, and Black was just about 2 miles this side of Bardwell. It is between here and Bardwell. It was mm-hmm. just outside Bardwell. And So we lived in Bartlett, and I went to school at the fifth or sixth grade, one or the other. That is the only time I ever had a teacher other than my daddy until my last 2 years in high school. And so he was they had had a barbecue at the school and had a barbecue pit where they barbecued. And the wood that is left over, logs and things, they just rolled into that pit. And Papa was playing ball with the boys at school and fell in the pit and broke both arms. And I can remember Mama fixing his lunch. He walked. All that winter, he loved to walk. And while we lived in Bardwell, he just walked back and forth to school. Mm-hmm. It was just a couple of miles. And so she would fix his lunch basket and take this arm, you know, and put her foot, slide it on, and then put this arm this way. He had both of them in sling, and the lunch bag is hanging on in here, and he'd start out for school. Mm. he loved children, and he loved people. And he took a great delight in children, and he always played games with them and everything.
Were most of the schools that he taught at one-teacher schools?
Or they were all one-teacher schools. Unless it was Wright. I'm not sure whether they had one or two there.
And he had to teach, was it all eighth grades?
All eighth grade. And see, that's why the schools I went to mm-hmm. until I got in high school.
Yeah. And were most of the students seated according to age or according to ability? In other words,
abilities. It wasn't according to ability.
So if you were 10 years old and you were in the fifth grade, so you sat with a fifth grade bunch, even if you could read on the...
Well, there wouldn't be so many in the school, you know.
Yeah,
yes,
no.
I guess more or less we did that. I really hadn't thought about that part of it, but I guess we did more or less.
Mm-hmm.
But we would sit there and listen to all these little primer, you know, pupils and everything. I can remember listening. One day, Papa had this little girl reciting, and it is ladybug, fly away home. If you're not a ladybug, why did you come? And she said, ladybug, fly if you're not a ladybug, what'd you come here for? She'd memorize that.
Yeah. Right. Was it? Did you ever have any difficulty being the teacher's daughter?
Well, I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. Yeah. I think he was a little more strict on me.
Yeah.
And I really think that it was a little hard.
How about with the kids? Did the other kids treat you well?
Well, they were always pretty nice every now and then. Of course, if they got mad at Papa, they'd be, I guess, mad at me.
Yeah.
But they were pretty nice, take it all in all. I can't remember ever being mistreated that way.
Can you remember the subjects that you had?
Oh, we studied the old, I had mostly the McGuffey books, you know,
yeah.
And they started in about the sixth grade, didn't they? They
yeah.
have the readers,
uh-huh.
And we'd spell. It is reading, writing, and arithmetic, and history. Papa loved history,
yeah.
And it wasn't what the history we had wasn't confined to our textbooks.
Right.
It was confined to what he knew about history,
yeah.
And he knew quite a bit about history.
Yeah.
And arithmetic was really his love and something I hated. And,
yeah.
But he used to, as a pastime, I know one time he was clearing a new ground, and he would solve problems in higher mathematics. And if any of the teachers in the county got hung up on a problem, which didn't happen but once or twice, they'd come to Papa to solve them. He could solve them. But he'd take a problem in higher mathematics with him in his mind and go out, and as he cleared ground, he'd solve it.
Following is a continuation of an unrehearsed interview with Avis Graves of Bardwell, Carlisle County, Kentucky. This interview was conducted by John Marshall for the Kentucky Oral History Commission in Miss Graves' home near Bardwell on August the 7th, 1978, at approximately 11 a.m.
In your classes, in your school, did you have geography?
In geography.
You did have geography.
Uh-huh, yes, we had geography.
Did you have anything like civics, or was that mostly taught in the...
No, we not in the grade schools, we
uh-huh.
didn't.
Yeah.
Now, when we got into high school, we did with Latin, and I had 4 years of Latin,
yeah.
You know, at that time they majored in high school.
Where did you go to high school?
Arlington. I went to the Arlington High. Excuse Papa's brother.
Uncle what?
H-A-R-D-I-N. And we called him Hard.
Uh-huh.
He was like Papa. He taught at a lot of the little schools, and then he taught at Milburn, and he taught at Arlington, and for years he was principal at Bardwell, and then for years and years he was superintendent of education of Carlisle County. And he was really a character, if there ever was one. He was a very delightful person. And while I was in Mississippi, it was the second year of the World's Fair, he wrote me and said, "Agnes, how would you like to go to Chicago to the World's Fair?" And he had his son lived up there. Visit Bill and Megan and go to the World's Fair. Well, I'd been the year before, but I couldn't turn down the trip with Uncle Hard, so I wrote and told him, yeah, I would. And I got time off from where I was working and came up here. Well, he had a two-seated car with a rumble seat. What do you call them? A coupe with a rumble seat. And I was staying. He was a widower, and he came out of my ass where I was staying. He said, well, said Mary Elizabeth Beard and her brother want to go with us, and said, I think that would be nice. I said, yes, that'll be fine. And he came out a few days later, and Mary Elizabeth was a teacher in the county, a young teacher, just started. And well, Mary Catherine Fisher would like to go, and that'll be fine, he said. And I said, yeah, that'll be fine. And so Mary Catherine was also a young teacher. Then he came out one day and he says, Mildred Bishop is just dying to go, and I think she ought to go, and she was a young teacher. Now that was a one-seated car with a rumble. Mm-hmm. And so then he, that sounded like me, that was about all we could get in there, but he came back one day and he said, Betty Graves wants to go. She was about 12. Now, she was just a child, 10 or 12, I think maybe 10. And said, Betty would like to go, and say she won't take up much room, and said, so we'll just take her. Well, we got ready to go that morning, and there were 7 of us to ride in a one-seated car. Uncle Hard wasn't fazed. He says, well, let me see. We'll number ourselves. I'll be number 1 and I'll stay fixed and I'll drive. Number 2 sits next to me. Number 3 sits here. Number 4 sits in the rumble. Number 5 next to them. Number 6 next to them. And number 7 will just sit wherever they can sit. Which was on number 3 in front, mostly, you know. And he says, and we'll drive, we won't go very far, and we'll all change places. And we rotated, we'd just drop up down a number, and it just worked like clockwork. So he got us all 7 in, and of course, no place for baggage, and we had it tied all over the car. Yeah. And Betty was the last one, the little girl, was the last one to get on there. And they tied her suitcase on the front fender. Well, it was raining that morning, and there we were with the rumble seat. So we got an umbrella. And that didn't protect us much, so we got an oil cloth and put over the umbrella. And we took off for Chicago. And we got the road was being built then from here, and wasn't any bridge at Cairo. So we got up to, finally made it up to the ferry, rolled onto the ferry, and all got out. And the man that had the ferry said, would you all mind getting back in and letting me see? He says, I don't believe you all came out of there. Well, we'd go, we'd drive a certain number of miles, and we'd stop and get just a few gallons of gasoline, and everybody would change places. Yeah. And it worked out fine. We got to Chicago just fine. It just worked beautifully.
How long did it take you to get to Chicago?
Well, we in one day. And we'd be going up through Illinois, and Uncle Hard would say, that's a pretty field of corn over there, and we'd take off to the field of corn. He was a terrible driver, but, you know, this was long before too many good roads, you know, back in 1930-something. Okay. Well, we got to Chicago, and that night we went downtown. First night, I believe, we were there. All 7 of us landed on Bill and Lillian, a couple in Chicago, and they had 2 children. Can you imagine? And we stayed a long time. But anyway, we went down, Uncle Hard, and just the 7 of us went down to the Chicago Theater, I think it was. It was, I think, a movie, and maybe a vaudeville or something like that. And we all went in, and there was an aisle seat, so people stood up to let us in. And we all got settled down and hadn't been sitting there but just a few minutes until there was a up the line, you know, this whispering going on. Uncle Hard was, I was sitting next to Uncle Hard, and he said, what is it? They said, Betty's lost her purse. Well, he said, we better go and see about it. Instead of just him getting up to go, we all 7 got up, made these people stand up, and we all went out and went around down to the lost and found department. And Uncle Hard says, the little girl's lost her purse. And the girl said, no. What kind of purse was it, honey? And she said, a white beaded bag. And she said, did it have any money in it? No, but it cost 39 cents. She said, and she laughed, the girl laughed, and she said, well, what did it have in it? And she says, a lunchbox handle. And you know, she had the purse and it had the lunchbox. And that was all she had in it, was a little beaded 39 cent. She must not have been 10. She must have been younger than that. Anyway.
A lunchbox handle?
A lunchbox handle she had taken off of the box of her, the school lunchbox. She had that handle in that purse. And why, I don't know. But that was all she had there. Uncle Hard was keeping her money, of course. That is just one of the many things. It was like that all the time we were in Chicago.
Oh, Ben, until we got back. Can you tell me some more? I'll bet that was a great trip. But you did it in a day. I can't believe you drove to Chicago from here today.
Oh, yes,
you
can
drive
to Chicago in a day.
Yeah.
Well, I need this for my nose. that was in the Depression, you know.
Yeah.
And the company that Bill had been with had folded. And he was working out at the fair that summer, and he worked at the Aquacade, where they, all the girls, they had the swimming show. And we'd go in and do the young teachers. They really had a big time together. And they'd take Betty with them, and Reed Davis, so there was the boy wasn't teaching, but he was a grown boy. There was three girls, and Betty and Reed, that is right. And so they had stayed out pretty late, and one night we were all there at Bill's, and we lived 21 miles out from the fairgrounds at Ivanhoe, Bill did. And so Bill came home, and none of the children had come home, and the shows had closed, and we were, of course, uneasy, getting very uneasy. And when he got home, because he didn't close until that show, until about midnight, you know, or later. And so he said, well, he'd just go back and see if he could find them. So he started back, and just as he got to the door, right here, 2 hours, he said, oh, here they come. Well, it was just the two Marys. And we said, where are the others? And they said, oh, we don't know. They got on the wrong train and went shooting off, and we don't know where they were. They had been standing at the, waiting for the train to the interurban thing. And when he came in, Mildred had the tickets, and she and Reed and Betty got on the thing and immediately realized they were on the wrong thing and tried to get off, but they couldn't. And left the two Marys there without any tickets, and the railroad brought them home for free. So they didn't know where they'd gone. Well, Bill went on then, and Dan. But by the time he got to the station where the others had come in, they went to the rode the train to the first station, and got off, and ran all the way back because they knew those two were there without any tickets, you know. And Betty can tell it's so funny. She was a little girl, and she said that they ran and said that if the storm coming up off of Lake Michigan, and said she was out of breath and says, I'd say, I know I'm going to have pneumonia. But they got back there, and so the railroad, well, of course, they had their tickets. No? Yeah, they didn't have to give them. They were on the wrong train. They didn't give them, so they got on home. Well, the next night I was down at the fair and stayed until Bill closed. We left there about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and when we got down to the station and said Ivanhoe, you know, we're getting tickets to Ivanhoe, they said, were the children who got lost last night, did they belong to you all? And we said, yes. Well, did they get home all right? Yeah, they got home fine. But it was something like that all the time, and on even on the way back, you know, things we'd lose and have to go back for and everything. But he was a grand person to travel with. Mm. He was just more fun.
What can you remember? What was the most impressive exhibit that you saw?
The only thing I went to the second year was to the, I believe it was the Austrian, I went to see the Austrian folk dances. To me, that was what I liked the most.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. I had seen them the year before and loved them. And so that's what I enjoyed most. Well, I stayed around I didn't go to the fair very much that second year.
What did you do?
Huh?
What did you do?
Well, I don't remember. I guess I went downtown.
Yeah.
Oh, another thing that really was rather unusual is in the days when you wore the long blouses that came almost to your knees, and Mary Elizabeth Beard had spent part of her school money on a gorgeous blouse. It was, and it had a self-material belt, which just made the blouse. You didn't wear them without your belt. Well, we were downtown one day in Chicago, and she lost her belt, and which ruined her blouse, and she was just heartsick. The next day, we went back to Chicago, downtown. I was downtown, I guess. And we were crossing there by, I started to say Macy's, it is Marshall Fields. I got them mixed up, New York and Chicago. And crossing the corner there at Marshall Fields, and Mary Elizabeth says, "Yonder is my belt." And it was stretched out along the curb. I guess the street sweepers and sweeping, it had just stretched out along the curb there. Had been there for a day. And she says, "Reed, go and get it." And he says, "I'm not going to do it. It's your belt. You go." He was her brother.
Yeah.
"You go and get it." So we retrieved her belt on the corner of Marshall Fields after he'd lost it one day and found it the next. Isn't that unusual?
Yeah, it certainly is. What was his name? Reed what?
Reed Davis.
Reed Davis.
Uh-huh. Mary Elizabeth Davis. And she was then. Of course, she's married now.
Yeah.
Married and a grandmother and great-grandmother, I guess.
Yeah. Well, when you went to Arlington High School, and then you said you took 4 years of Latin.
Yeah.
Right. When did you finish high school at Arlington, you know?
In 1917.
1917.
Oh, I know that very well.
Yeah. And how many students were there in your class that finished?
Seven graduated. Oh. See, that is in the days before consolidation.
Sure.
We had one boy and six girls.
Uh-huh. One boy and six girls.
Uh-huh. And of that number, there's, I guess five of us are still living. There's one of them I'm not sure about because she doesn't live here.
Did you have a reunion last year?
No, we never have had a reunion.
Is it right?
Uh-huh, never did have a reunion. That was a long time ago, 1917.
Sure. Can you, you took 4 years of Latin. You also took what, English?
Geometry. I love geometry. I didn't like...
math.
I didn't like algebra.
Yeah.
I didn't like math.
Yeah.
But I love geometry.
Yeah. Did you ever have any science courses?
No.
No.
Mm-hmm.
They just weren't taught at all until
we didn't have any at all.
Mm-hmm.
But we had a good English teacher.
What was his name?
Shakespeare. Well, it's her, and her name was Madge Cherry. She was, her husband was that Cherry that lived at the Cherry School.
Uh-huh.
And she was an excellent teacher, an excellent, that must have been my last 2 years I remember her. That is after Papa was gone there.
Do you remember if any of the teachers had any tertiary education at all?
Any what?
Had gone to any school past high school?
I'm sure the principal. The last 2 years of my high school, three years, because he taught 1 year with Papa. No, two, couldn't, yeah, he did. Professor E.E. Tarter, he was from the mountains of Mississippi, mountains of Kentucky. I lived in Mississippi so long.
Mm-hmm.
Mountains of Kentucky. And he was a graduate of UK, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty sure he was. And he was an excellent teacher. I don't know the one the first year, whether he had a degree or not, but I know, I'm sure Professor, we call him Professor Tarter, Mr. Tarter.
What did he teach?
What did he teach?
What subject did he?
I don't remember which ones they taught, really.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't remember.
But Madge Cherry was the English teacher.
She was, I remember that she was English. The reason I remember that was that we studied Shakespeare so much, you know.
Yeah.
She loved to read him and that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And Papa always loved literature and poetry, and we always, what little money he had to spend, he'd spend on books. We didn't have much.
When you finished high school, did you go straight to
no,
Mississippi?
No, well, I really couldn't afford to go to college. I wanted to. But my mother was an invalid from the time I was 8, and that is when I was 17. And she'd been in and out of hospitals, and we were really broke. So I did go up to Chillicothe, Missouri, to Chillicothe Business School for a term. I don't know whether it was just one term. Well, it was, I guess. I made several trips back and forth, though. Anyway, that's right. And that was all the other schooling I've ever had. I never did go to college.
But when did you go to Mississippi?
In 1920.
3 years after you finished
high school? Well, I finished high school and went to Chillicothe and came back home and worked as a bookkeeper for the canning factory there for a little while. And then I became assistant cashier of the Bank of Arlington at 18, I guess. And assistant cashier at the Bank of Arlington was bookkeeper and general flunky. But anyway, that was my title. I was assistant cashier. That was And I guess I'd been working there for about a year. And I got an unexpected vacation. The bank burned down one night. And it burned to the ground. And so, but I didn't have but about 2 days vacation, because as soon as it had cooled, the vaults withstood the heat, and all of our books and everything were in the vault. So as soon as we could get across the rubble, they laid planks to the vault doors, and Uncle Johnny Neville, the cashier, brought down his wife, Miss Annie's tea wagon, and we'd trundle that two-tiered tea wagon up to the vault door and load all the books on and trundle them down the street to the Arlington Courier, which is no more, the newspaper, that had a little thing sort of like a bank in front, although, you know, it had a counter, an enclosed counter. And so we did that while we arrived in the morning. We'd get the books and trundle them down to the Arlington Courier, and at night we'd trundle them and the money back up to the bank and put them in the vault. And we did that for I don't know how long, but I don't remember. And I know it must have been a lot of trouble, and I know we must have been a lot of trouble to the editor and his assistant down there being in their way. And but I don't remember that, and I just remember they were awfully nice to us, and everything went off very nicely. And when the new bank was built, and we got back in it, the fixtures were secondhand. They had been stored somewhere, and they smelled musty. And Miss Annie sent down some orris root to put in the drawers of the, all of the drawers around the enclosure. Have you ever smelled orris root?
Yeah. I don't think I'd be banking there either.
The Nevilles were awfully nice. Uncle Johnny Neville was a cashier there for years. So I was making the princely sum of $50, I think, maybe.
A month?
A month, yeah. I imagine. Maybe, I don't think I ever got to. No, it is 50. So I answered an ad in the Commercial Appeal. We were really needing money. Mama was still sitting in hospitals. So a firm at Memphis advertised for secretary, and I wrote and told them I was an expert in everything. Wasn't anybody better than me.
Sure. Well, you have to do that when you're applying for a job, don't you?
And I didn't hear from them, but I heard from an insurance firm in Meridian, Mississippi. The man that owned the insurance firm owned the lumber company in Memphis, and they kept that letter. I have seen it in later years, and boy, you know, it was really funny. Yeah. You know, it was so cocky, and so they kept it, and so they had sent it on down there because it was funny, and so they wrote and asked me about coming down there, and I thought, well, if I can get three times what I'm making here, I can afford to live down there and save some money. And I wrote and told them I'd come for $150, and they hired me. And I went to Meridian, Mississippi. And when I got there, this man was, I was the luckiest thing in the world. He was a patriarchal type. He didn't have any children of his own. And he millionaire, I guess, and he believed in helping people that, young people, you mm-hmm. know. So he had me back at, it was the man that hired me was his, of course, one of his assistants. And he took me back to see Boss. Everybody called him that all over the state of Mississippi. He was called Boss. And took me back to see him. And he said, "Little gal, have you got your place to stay in?" I said, "No, I'm still at the hotel, but I'll find a place." So he pulled the phone over and he called his niece and he said, "Dink, I've got a little gal here from Kentucky that needs a place to stay. Don't you think your mother-in-law could give her a room?" She was a widow and had a big house. Mm-hmm. And I lived with her. She was just like my mother for years. Mm-hmm. I was lucky, just awfully lucky.
Uh-huh. When did you go to Mississippi? What year was it?
1920. And stayed till 1949.
29 years.
Uh-huh.
That is a long
time. In the meantime, I took a tour of duty in the Army during the Second World War.
Oh, did you?
Well, right after the Battle of the Bulge, they called for women. Of course, I was 45. They called for women to help in hospitals. Mm-hmm. They thought the war was going to last a long time, longer than it did. Mm-hmm. And they were wanting women to work in hospitals. And I knew the office would let me off if I wanted off, and they did. So I was thinking about it and I stopped in to ask about it, and that's a mistake, don't ever ask.
Sounds so good.
Because I was in when I left.
Yeah.
But I wasn't ever sorry, mm-hmm. but it was an entirely different life.
Mm.
I went to basic training, and then I wanted to be a nurse's aide, so I didn't tell them about any of my, that I could write on a typewriter. I never had used my shorthand that I learned at Chillicothe, mm. and all my life I never used it. And so I just didn't, but I wound up, I imagine on account of my age, they called for 10,000 women, and they joined, they got them within just such a short time, that I never had a pillow to sleep on until I left basic training. They just mm. couldn't supply us, we all joined at once,
mm-hmm.
and they took, after we finished basic, they took 2,000 for what they called executive work, and so that's what they put me in that 2,000. I didn't get to be a nurse's aide. After all, I wound up at headquarters at one of the hospitals, a 2,500-bed hospital.
Where was that?
At Jackson, Mississippi. They gave us a choice of hospitals. And I took Memphis as my first choice because I thought it'd be halfway between Mississippi and here. But I didn't get that, but I got my second mm-hmm. choice and went back to Jackson. And there I was working for $65 a month back in the same town. But I tell you, it wasn't the same. Mm-hmm. I was out, you know, when you're in the Army, you're in the Army.
Mm-hmm. Well, when were you in Jackson before?
That's right. In 1940, we decided to set up a service office in Jackson.
Oh, I see.
And I was one of the ones that to Jackson to help establish the new office.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So how long were you in the Army altogether?
Oh, less than a year because the war ended,
sure.
You know.
Okay.
Yeah. I kept trying to get out as soon as it was over. Later on I thought maybe the reason they kept me a little while longer, I imagine they kept me long enough so that I'm really qualified for benefits, I think, if anything should come up. And I don't know why else they would have, because they certainly didn't need me.
Mm.
In fact, they never had needed us.
Mm.
They never had really needed us, but we were there. And it was quite an experience, and I don't regret it at all.
Mm-hmm.
I was glad that I had that experience.
Were most of the women who answered that call for 10,000 like you, or were they?
Most of them were young,
mm-hmm.
but there were a few. Now there were very few older than I.
Mm-hmm.
They took them up to 50.
Mm-hmm.
You could be up to 50. No, most of them were young,
mm-hmm.
and the bunch that I that was funny. I had a very dear friend whose son was in the Air Corps. And she would say, well, Avis, I don't see why you don't join. You could stay. She was 10 years older than I. You can get in. I'm too old, she'd say, but you could get in. Then I had another friend that said, well, Avis, I don't see why you don't go. You're physically able and I'm not. I'd played golf and stayed, you know, limber and could walk. And thank goodness, or I'd died during basic. So when I stopped in Meridian to ask about it, I was really in, and I was sent to, I hadn't been sworn in though, and I was sent back to Jackson, you know. During the war, I worked both offices. I'd go down to the Jackson office in the morning and take me a dress on a hanger and a little bag in this hand, and I'd work there until the train came in. Somebody would run me down to the train, I'd get on the train and I'd go over to Meridian, hang my dress up on the, there was a little old dinky local that went between Meridian, and it's just 100 miles. And then I'd go to Meridian and stay there a while, and then I'd come back. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the way I did here in the. And so when I went to be sworn in at Jackson, the captain who was in charge of the swearing in happened to work for the same company I did in Pennsylvania. She worked for a lawyer for the firm in Pennsylvania. And so she said, Miss Graves, are you right sure you want to join the Army? And I said, well, I think so. Yeah, you're some mighty serious stuff, she said. I said, yeah, I know it. She said, I'll tell you, it's just as serious as marriage. And then she said, in fact, it's more serious. Says you can get out of a marriage, but says you can't get out of this. You sign for the duration, you know. But anyway, I did. And it was a very motley bunch that joined with me. And of course, being my age, while I was put in charge of the detachment to take the basic training. And two of them didn't show up the train. I was frantic. And here they finally came, and they both were high as kites. And one of them had her ex-husband with her. And she'd start to get on the train, and he'd pull her off. And I'd pull her on, and he'd But I was in charge of them, and I signed them. I finally, with the help of the conductor, got her on, and we pulled out. And I signed them all their bunks, and I put these two that were drunk underneath me, and I swept up above them. But did you know one of them one time did me a great favor at basic training? They were making us carry our beds out to air, and I couldn't carry a bed. I just couldn't lift it, a mattress. I just couldn't do it. And she did it for me, bless her heart.
Sorry. When you got out of the Army, you stayed in Jackson, really, and worked for the same firm?
I came back up here for a while, and then I decided I wanted to go back to the office, and I went back to Meridian. Mm. Let me see, did I? And then I guess I went back to Jackson, didn't I? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, I did. Yeah, I was at Jackson when I came up here. I worked so much at both places that I sort of forgot. Well, and I had worked there so long, I got so that I really, reading the things that I wrote then and so on and so forth, I don't think I did much work, to tell you the truth. Which I didn't like. I like to stay busy. And they'd say, well, you've been here so long, you're due to do, you know, take things so easy. So.
What was the name of the firm that you worked for?
I worked for the United States Fidelity and Guarantee Company. I saw a program on Hugh Downs yesterday on television. The Life of Pearl book was by the USF. But I worked for F.W. Williams State Agency. It was a state agency. They have branch offices in all the big cities. A state agency is something you can't get. This man I talked about, Boss, was a personal friend of the founder of the company. He and Howard Bland in Maryland were real good friends. And he got a state agency. They're not any state agencies. They have branch offices. Mm-hmm. And they still have that state agency in Mississippi. Mm-hmm. Just for that connection back way back. Mm-hmm.
And you worked with them until 1949 when you mm-hmm. came up, back up here.
Mm-hmm.
And helped your uncle run a...
Well, he had this, he had bought, Uncle Hard had bought this old store downtown. And what? Why in the world, I don't know. And it didn't have, and he had had a couple in there running it, and they'd run it into the ground. It just didn't have anything. In fact, one of the salesmen I bought it from, he sold it to me on very liberal, practically gave it to me to get rid of it. And one of the first salesmen that called on me says, for goodness sakes, change your name. It had had a bad reputation, you know. Mm-hmm. It had just run to nothing.
Well, what was the name of the store?
I don't remember. I believe Bardwell Paint and Glaze.
What did you call it?
I called it Graves Paint and Gift Shop. Hmm. It's still down. Still down there. I sold it to a cousin in, a few years ago and retired. I don't do anything.
Except write for the paper.
Hmm?
Except write for the paper?
That, well, yeah. Hmm. I do that. But I just... That is one of the things you just happened into, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I ran into Dorothy. I was down at the store, down at my old store one day, and Doris Brown was in there, and I said, what are you looking for? And she said, oh, I've got to find a present for Mike to take back to some friends of his in Scotland on his way to the Mideast. And so I thought, well, that sounds interesting. People don't really know that people in Bardwell do things like that. And I said, so I got her to tell me about Mike and mm-hmm. his job. I don't believe he's at Kuwait. He's in, or maybe it's Saudi Arabia, I believe. And so she told me. Well, and then there was something else. I've forgotten what the other thing was, but there were two things. And I wrote them up and took them into the paper and told them, I said, I think these, you know, this would be interesting. People would be interested in it. And so, of course, I knew the editor real well. In fact, she's a sister to my niece-in-law. And so she said, well, Abby said, how about writing us something every week? I said, oh, no, not on a bet. I wouldn't do it. And so she said, I'm going to run it under your name. And I said, well, it doesn't, I don't care, it's just two little items, you know. And so, but it, she did, she put run it under my name, and Mary Key Bodkin called me the next week, and she said, Alice, said, I got something for you next issue. And it was about her boy in Germany. And you know, you hate, I think people are, they, it's yeah. too bad that you can't write about them, you know.
Yeah.
And he has the most interesting job over there. He works in the, what is the hospital? Used to be the headquarters for the SS forces. And it's built underground. I guess they thought, you know, and then as mm-hmm. well, of course, it's some under, but a lot of it's underground, and mm-hmm. it's huge.
Yeah.
And I wrote up, so that's where I started,
mm-hmm.
you know. And so I told Mary Ellen, I said, well, I guess I'll try it, you know.
When did that start? When did you start writing for the paper? Sounds like it's recent.
Oh, it was. Last year, I guess. Mm-hmm. 77, I guess. Uh-huh.
Well, that's pretty good. Uh-huh.